Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's Authoritarian Playbook series. Today, we're talking about why many media outlets and journalists still hesitate to call Donald Trump and his policies authoritarian. Since returning to the White House, Trump has sent federal troops to U.S. cities, deployed ICE agents wearing masks to carry out violent immigration raids, sued and censored independent journalists and media outlets, pressured universities to align with his far-right agenda, and directed the DOJ to persecute his political enemies. Fascism scholars like Jason Stanley say this is textbook authoritarianism, but many media outlets still refuse to use this word. Why is that? And why does it matter? In his Stop the Presses piece, Why Don't the Media Say Trump is Becoming a Dictator?, longtime journalist Mark Jacob writes, journalists have a duty to warn the public of threats to their safety and well-being. They fail in that duty when they report on individual pieces of a disaster without providing the big picture. The big picture is the fact that Donald Trump is building a dictatorship. Mark Jacob is former Metro editor of the Chicago Tribune and former Sunday editor of the Chicago Sun-Times. He's co-author of 10 books, mostly on history. Mark Jacob now writes the Stop the Presses newsletter about how right-wing extremism exploits the weaknesses in U.S. journalism and what we can do about it. Hi, Mark. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
In her piece for The Conversation, Why Journalists Are Reluctant to Call Trump an Authoritarian and Why It Matters for Democracy, Dr. Karen Vasby Anderson writes that because authoritarianism is most visible in hindsight, people often don't recognize it until it's too late. And that's why it's important for journalists to label authoritarians as such when the evidence warrants. Dr. Karen Vasby Anderson is professor of communication studies at Colorado State University. She's the author or editor of 3 books on gender and political culture. Dr. Karen Vasby Anderson's political commentary and research has been published in many outlets, including the Associated Press and The Guardian. Hi, Professor Anderson. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for the invitation. It's great to be here.
It's great to have both of you. I want to ask you both about fear in this country. We decided to start this authoritarian playbook back in August because we felt like too many media outlets were not connecting the dots. And there's just so much to cover in this administration, we can't keep up. So what we do is summarize the news on this weekly series, put it in historical context, and then talk about how people are responding. And I'm going to be honest with you. When Charlie Kirk was shot on September 11th, I really wanted to lay low. I didn't want to publicize the authoritarian playbook. I was almost afraid to use that word because of political violence, because this country is so armed, because tensions are so high. And I wonder if you think that is one reason why a lot of journalists and media outlets are hesitant to use words like authoritarian or dictator. Karen, let's start off with you. What are your thoughts on that?
There certainly is a lot of fear circulating, and I think some of it is well justified, and some of it is created by authoritarianism itself. So I think that, you know, one of the reasons that I think journalists have been in kind of a double bind on this issue is that even if, you know, like Mark, they are brave enough to come out and call authoritarianism what it is and name it out loud. There's professional standards that suggest, you know, like, well, are people going to think that I'm being a biased journalist if I call a Republican an authoritarian and I'm not applying those kinds of labels to the Democrats? So I think there is fear for people's safety, that's, you know, sort of one level. Fear for do we want to intensify partisanship in our culture? But then also fear that we don't want to violate our own professional norms. And I think those are a lot of forces that journalists are impacted by.
Hmm. Mark, what are your thoughts on this? Because you know that if a journalist is... It's very easy for people on the right, well, people across the board, really, to target someone. You can be doxxed. I mean, it can be hell. A number of, especially women journalists have said this about how hard it is to come back from something like that. So what are your thoughts specifically about the fear, especially around the killing of Charlie Kirk? Because that was something that was so horrific and instilled fear in a lot of people.
Well, I mean, I feel like the Kirk thing, there was really a very clear position to be in, which was to denounce violence, you know, but it shouldn't have quieted people who were concerned about what Kirk said or what Trump says, you know, and so, I mean, it's a shame if that intimidated people. As far as the fear, Trump is, he's picking out individual reporters and, you know, saying quiet piggy, or, you know, calling them, you know, complaining that they're not compliant and they're being rude to people when they ask him, you know, questions. And he's making the media into targets. So I understand why people might be, you know, scared of that. To me, the biggest reason why you don't see people calling what Trump's doing building a dictatorship, is, which is the language I like to use, is because the media's bosses don't want them to. I mean, and I feel like the access issue is really there, that if you ask too tough questions, you're going to be kicked out of the room. And you know, the bosses want you to be in the room because you're part of the show.
Can you elaborate on that, Mark?
Well, what I mean is that in order to, if you're covering the White House, you want interviews, you want your texts and calls returned. You want you to be called on in press conferences. And if none of those things happen, then your bosses back in the office think that you failed in some way. So, and Trump, you know, and his people know this. And so, you know, this is why they, you know, they were trying to kick the Associated Press out of the room, simply because they wouldn't say, you know, Gulf of America, which right. A really petty move on their part. But they know that these mainstream outlets, they need to be there. They need to have their correspondents asking questions. They need to be players in the whole, what has unfortunately become kind of a show, which is what these White House press conferences have become. And they want to be part of that. And to be kicked out of it I think that the mainstream media, not independent media as much, but mainstream media thinks that they've got to be part of the whole performance. And therefore, access is an enormous issue that makes the media timid.
Karen, what would you add on access?
I think that's super important. I would also say that one of the challenges for independent journalists is the Trump administration's litigiousness, their propensity to sue. So the reason that we need these large media organizations is in part because they have funds to defend a lawsuit when they are inevitably raised. But if somebody isn't an independent journalist, you know, a lot of journalists who cover Trump have followings. Some of them have lost their jobs and they've continued on Substack. But if you've lost that institutional protection that, you know, would back you up in a lawsuit, that's another kind of fear that, all right, well, can I do this story or is it going to bankrupt me?
Can you also talk about why this is important? Because a lot of people might not even know what the word authoritarian means. Or if you say the word dictator, they might say, what are you talking about? That could never happen in this country. In fact, we had a series last year on Project 2025. And what continued to come up in these shows from listeners is that could never happen here. People just don't think it's possible for something like this to happen in the United States. So Karen, in your piece and the conversation, you write that because authoritarianism is visible in hindsight, people often don't recognize it until it's too late. And that's why it's important for journalists to label authoritarians as such when the evidence warrants. But how do you deal with that when people might not know what that means exactly?
That is such a good question. And so, yeah, I would say that If we're talking about healthy democracy and fascism, we've got a continuum. And so you've got sort of a spectrum. And the scholars Stephen Levitsky and David Ziblatt wrote a book called How Democracies Die. And they talk about something called competitive authoritarianism. And what competitive authoritarianism is when there's a constant push and pull between democracy and autocracy. But what characterizes it is you have a leader or a political party who, once they are voted into power, so they gain their authority democratically, but then they're willing to use the office that they were elected to tilt the playing field against their political opponents, and to use whether it's the Justice Department or the Homeland Security Office, they're using those offices in a way that make it harder and harder for Democrats to get elected or for critics to get their voices heard. So they're using the power of the government to quell what's normally a healthy democratic response in a free society. So
I think that's a really good point, because I mean, they have elections in Russia. They just don't mean anything. I mean, it's if you get popular enough to challenge the authority figure, you end up in prison or dead in prison, you know? So that's the real threat that people need to grasp, is that our whole election process is being assaulted by the Republicans all the time, you know, and that the whole thing in Texas where they're this mid-decade gerrymandering and this assault on mail-in voting, which is very popular and has had very, very little fraud. They're assaulting our voting processes because they like the idea that people feel like they can vote and that they have a chance. And yes, we're really still a democracy, but we're not, because they have rigged the entire system. And so I think that's a great point.
And Mark, what would you say to the question about how do you talk about this, given that a lot of people don't really know what these words mean, authoritarian, for example, or dictator, and some people still say that could never happen in the United States?
Yeah, well, I don't know what you do with people who don't understand what the word dictator means. I mean, because they should. And if they don't, I just don't know how you save them. But what bothers me is when it doesn't go, when you have all this kind of weasel language, like you see the New York Times, you know, saying, you know, that, well, he's inverted the facts. And, you know, they use all these kind of weird phrases that they invent. I've speculated that the New York Times has a euphemism desk where they make up these facts so they can avoid saying directly what's happening. My main point, one of my central points in what's wrong with news coverage today of the Trump regime, is that they're not doing a bad job on reporting all the little bits of authoritarianism out there, you know, Trump ordering his Justice Department to go after his enemies, for example, or him just blowing up boats in international waters just because he feels like it. I mean, things like that. They're not doing a bad job of that, but what they're doing a terrible job of is putting it all together and you know, hitting the total button on it and making it clear to people that all of these things go in the direction of somebody assuming total power over you and the fact. So it's this like drip, drip, drip. But they never there's never this modulation of alarm. There's never this holy crap, Trump is building a dictatorship. And I'm telling you, if major media would write headlines that said Trump is building a dictatorship, they could construct entire stories that would give so much evidence that this is true. It's not really even a question anymore. That's what's happening. But they won't say it.
Well, and that's why we started this series. You write, Mark, that the failure to do that keeps us sliding toward authoritarianism.
Yeah, I actually use the metaphor of the frog. You know, people like to talk about the frog in the boiling water, that, you know, if you put a frog in boiling water, he'll immediately jump out. If you put a frog in lukewarm water and then slowly raise the temperature, he'll get boiled to death. Well, the funny thing is, that is not even true. Experts say that the frog will jump out. It's kind of a false metaphor. But the real question in America today is whether the major news media are as smart as frogs.
Karen, how much of this is about the old playbook that many journalists still use, playing devil's advocate, for example, providing, quote, balance, saying that there are two sides to every story. In your piece in The Conversation, you give an example of this. You write that when California Governor Gavin Newsom gave a speech asserting Trump's military response to immigration protests in California was an assault on democracy, the New York Times quoted Newsom at length about the danger Trump presented. The article then quoted Republicans who allege that Newsom's public health directives during COVID made him the ultimate authoritarian.
Right. And there are so many examples of things like that. I think one thing that is important for us to realize about the norm of journalistic balance is that while it did emerge in the mid-20th century from sort of journalism schools and the professionalization of journalism, journalists pride themselves in being independent and reporting just the facts and presenting all sides. All of that is true. But it also comes from another pressure, and that is the pressure for people to subscribe to and read your journalism or watch it, as the case may be. And so if you want to have a broad audience for as a mainstream journalistic outlet, you can't afford to alienate half the country. So there's a business incentive for them to do what that example demonstrated. And I think that's why we're seeing some of the higher ups, the people who own these newspapers, influential newspapers and news outlets, you know, putting some pressure on their journalists to not alienate, you know, half of the country with their coverage. And the problem is, in a country as polarized as ours is, if you're going to tell the truth about how the Republicans are behaving, that's going to be fairly alienating to everybody who identifies as a Republican.
And there are real consequences to all of this. I'm thinking about public radio. The Republican Party has for decades tried to defund the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and they finally succeeded. Starting in October, we lost funding across the board. We're seeing stations shut down. I just saw some very sad news from Current about PBS shutting down their West Coast Bureau. That is a huge loss for the PBS NewsHour. So what about that? Can you talk more about that, Karen, how that affects the coverage once the administration sues you and then in the case of public broadcasting, completely defund you altogether?
Yeah, well, it's a disaster. It's a slow-moving train wreck that we're all just kind of watching. Of course, the crisis in local news has been going on for decades. We've had, you know, small news outlets close. In Colorado, we used to have two big Denver papers. And as a result, they held our state and local politicians feet to the fire. You know, that kind of reporting prevents corruption. So as you are losing, say, your local NPR affiliate, you are losing the ability to hold local and state level politicians to account. So it's a disaster to be defunding news or to be handing news over to billionaires or very large corporations who do not have commitments to journalism itself. I mean, when Jeff Bezos bought the Washington Post, you know, initially he said that he was not going to exercise any editorial control. And for a long time, it seemed like he didn't. But after Donald Trump was reelected, that changed very quickly, and he changed the composition of his opinion page and such. So both the defunding of public funds to very local stations and the yielding of really big national outlets to individuals and corporations has created a perfect storm of lost information for the public.
Dr. Karen Vazbee Anderson is professor of communication studies at Colorado State University. She's the author or editor of three books on gender and political culture. We're also joined today by Mark Jacob, former Metro editor of the Chicago Tribune and former Sunday editor of the Chicago Sun-Times and co-author of 10 books, mostly on history. Mark Jacob now writes the Stop the Press's newsletter about how far-right extremism exploits the weaknesses in American journalism and what we can do about it. On today's Authoritarian Playbook series, we're talking about why many media outlets and journalists still hesitate to call Trump and his policies authoritarian and why it matters. If you have a question for our guests, we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on media coverage of Trump's policies. And then the point that Mark makes about how they might be talking about everyday policies, but there are very few big picture pieces saying that this is authoritarian. So what are your thoughts about what you're hearing and seeing in the media? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. Which outlets do you think are doing a good job of this? And which outlets do you think are not doing a very good job? You can also email your call at kalw.org. I'd like to ask both of you about Trump suing media outlets and threatening media outlets. And here's the latest example. Yesterday at the White House, ABC White House correspondent Mary Bruce asked Trump why he had not released the Epstein files.
Mr. President, why wait for Congress to release the Epstein files? Why not just do it now?
Well, it's not the question that I mind, it's your attitude. I think you are a terrible reporter. It's the way you ask these questions. I think the license should be taken away from ABC because your news is so fake and it's so wrong. And we have a great commissioner, the chairman, who should look at that, because I think when you come in and when you're 97% negative to Trump and then Trump wins the election in a landslide, that means obviously your news is not credible and you're not credible as a reporter.
So that is Trump talking to an ABC reporter. Recently, Trump said that NBC should fire Seth Meyers, and FCC Chair Brendan Carr reposted that. What role is this playing, Mark, in how the media are covering Trump?
Well, the FCC is completely corrupted. Brendan Carr, who's head of the Federal Communications Commission, is clearly threatening major media if they don't do what he says. He tried to get Jimmy Kimmel's show canceled, but Disney figured out that it would cost him more money to cancel it than to keep it. This is one thing that needs to be clarified. These big ABC, CBS, and NBC, they don't have licenses that he can cancel. But what they do have is individual local affiliates, all of whom have licenses that he could cancel. And therefore, that's why he's got, a financial threat against these networks. You ended up a situation where CBS got sold and the merger was approved only after CBS agreed to pay Trump money for a bogus lawsuit over the Kamala Harris interview on 60 Minutes. So, they really are at war with a free press. They're constantly trying to intimidate people. And one of the things I have written a couple columns about things to look for to see if we have become a dictatorship. And one of the things I point out is this, that what we need to look for, which really hasn't happened that much yet, is this ramping up of lawsuits against individual news outlets. Because, Trump's done it in some cases, but the right wing's got enough money that they could do it in hundreds of cases. They could assault the news media with these bogus lawsuits, which, whether they're bogus or not, you gotta defend against them. And that if we start seeing even more of that happening, that will be a clear sign that that it's an all-out offensive to destroy the free press.
Karin, what would you add?
So this example is a great one for understanding what the difference is between competitive authoritarianism and sort of old school fascism. If a dictator didn't want a journalist to have a story, and let's say we're in the 20th century Soviet Union, the dictator themselves could just throw the reporter in jail or order that news station to be closed, or they would do this direct action. What's different about competitive authoritarianism is Trump uses the levers that he has, which is this, in this case, that he controls the FCC. And they just say, in social media, they do a social media campaign, or they say in press conferences, boy, it sure would be terrible if you lost your license, or boy, it sure would be terrible if Skydance couldn't get its merger done. And then the people at Skydance, or the people at ABC, or the people at Disney, they have to make the decision to take somebody off the air, or in the case of Stephen Colbert, decide that they won't renew his show again. I mean, Jimmy Kimmel got back on the air, but Stephen Colbert, right now, the plan is for him to be done in the spring. And that was in response to this sort of pressure put very publicly that the Trump administration and Brendan Carr put on that corporation. So that's how competitive authoritarianism works. It's not necessarily the government taking away somebody's First Amendment rights in the way that it happens, say, in China. But it is using those levers in ways that past presidents have not used them to silence journalists.
You know, another way of applying pressure is evidenced by Washington Post. Because Bezos owns the Washington Post, but he also owns, you know, some other much bigger companies, you know, such as, you know, Amazon and Blue Origin. And he doesn't want the government messing with that. Blue Origin has government contracts, and Amazon requires a lot of government cooperation in order to deliver things to people and do its commerce. So the Washington Post is really a minor player for Bezos economically, and so he's willing to compromise the integrity of the Washington Post in order to buy Trump's assent to his other businesses.
And there's so many. Go ahead, Karin.
Oh, sorry about that. We're seeing other examples like that. Like a smaller example like that would be what happened recently to Teen Vogue. So I don't know how many people read Teen Vogue, but in the last 2 years, it's had some of the most progressive and hard-hitting reporting on the Trump administration that we've seen. But very recently, they just fired, Teen Vogue fired all of their political reporters and said that the brand was going to be absorbed into the larger Vogue brand. And the statement said something like, you know, we're just going to focus on issues that, you know, our younger readers are really in interested in. Well, the younger readers were very interested in what Teen Vogue was saying about the Trump administration, but there's this organizational shuffle at the top, and then suddenly these Teen Vogue reporters get summarily fired.
I know, and they've been doing some really incredible reporting over the last 2 years.
So they really have.
They have.
Not
it's
anymore.
Really a
not
loss
anymore.
For people who read Teen Vogue. What were you about to say, Mark?
No, I'm saying not anymore. So this right. is a case where the Trump regime has managed to silence a critic, a news source that was a critic. And this is happening. They want it to happen a lot more, you know, and this is why corporate ownership of major media outlets is a really big problem, because they can apply a lot of different pressure to the corporation and a lot of different angles, a lot of different places. And that's what we need is news organizations run by and owned by people who care about the news, who care about journalism, who aren't just caring about their other unrelated business enterprises.
Well, and just a quick reminder, because things are moving so fast, Paramount, the owner of CBS, which is now owned by David Ellison, the son of Larry Ellison, paid Trump millions of dollars to settle lawsuits, along with Disney, the owner of ABC. Earlier this year, the White House banned Associated Press reporters from the Oval Office and other events after the AP refused to change the name of the Gulf of Mexico to the Gulf of America. The White House also prohibited a Wall Street Journal reporter from boarding Air Force One to cover Trump's trip to Scotland earlier this year, after the paper published a piece on July 17th called Jeffrey Epstein's Friends Sent Him Body Letters for a 50th Birthday. One was from Donald Trump. And then Trump filed a $10 billion defamation suit against News Corp, which owns the Wall Street Journal. So I just wanted to mention those things because it's so hard sometimes to remember what happened just a few months ago because things are moving so fast. Today on the Authoritarian Playbook series, we're talking about why many media outlets and journalists still hesitate to call Trump and his policies authoritarian and why that matters. Today, we're joined by Dr. Karin Vazbee Anderson, professor of communication studies at Colorado State University. You can find her latest piece at The Conversation, Why Journalists Are Reluctant to Call Trump an Authoritarian and Why That Matters for Democracy. Mark Jacob is former Metro editor of the Chicago Tribune, former Sunday editor of the Chicago Sun-Times. He now writes the Stop the Presses newsletter. And you can find his piece at his Stop the Presses site, Why Won't the Media Say Trump is Becoming a Dictator? You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call's Authoritarian Playbook series. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we're talking about why many media outlets and journalists still hesitate to call Trump and his policies authoritarian and why it matters. Today, we're joined by Dr. Karin Vazbee Anderson, professor of communication studies at Colorado State University, and Mark Jacob, former Metro editor of the Chicago Tribune, former Sunday editor of the Chicago Sun-Times. He now writes the Stop the Presses newsletter. Before we get to calls, I want to play two more clips. So this is Trump demeaning women reporters in the last few months, and this clip was compiled by Midas Touch.
Will you let me finish my statement? You are the worst. You're with Bloomberg, right? You are the worst. I don't know why they even have you.
Quiet.
That's fake news. That's fake news.
Well, why would you go to the Department of Defense?
Listen, be quiet. Listen. You don't listen. You never listen. That's why you're second grade.
Well, you don't know much about crypto. You know nothing about nothing. You fake news.
But let me do it now.
You know, it's not the question that I mind. It's your attitude. I think you are a terrible reporter. It's the way you ask these questions. You start off with a man who's highly respected, asking him a horrible, insubordinate, and just a terrible question, and. You could even ask that same exact question nicely. You're all psyched, or somebody psychs you over at ABC, you're gonna psych it. You're a terrible person and a terrible reporter.
Oh, fake news, CNN?
Here, I'll hold it.
Oh, yeah, here we go. Wait till you hear this question.
Thank you, sir.
You should really say how great.
Who are you with?
And the same to you, Mr. President.
Now, who are you with?
I'm with ABC News, sir.
You're with who?
ABC News, sir.
Fake news. ABC fake news. One of the worst. One of the worst in the business.
So we should say that one of those responses came after a reporter asked about the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. So on Tuesday, and I'm reading here from ABC, Trump angrily defended Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman during his trip to the U.S., his first trip in 7 years, saying that what the Saudi royal has done is, quote, incredible in terms of human rights, and dismissed questions about the journalist Jamal Khashoggi's murder. U.S. intelligence said MBS approved of an operation that led to the murder of Khashoggi, a Washington Post columnist and Saudi critic, by Saudi agents in Istanbul. And Trump said, quote, things happen, but he knew nothing about it, and we can leave it at that, when the prince was asked about Khashoggi's murder. We should also mention that after a journalist from Bloomberg tried to ask a follow-up question about Epstein, this is a woman, Trump turned to her and said, quiet, quiet, piggy. And I want to play one more clip. We'll get responses and then we'll take calls. So Trump was recently on CBS's 60 Minutes with Nora O'Donnell. And now 60 Minutes, which is owned by CBS and Paramount, is now owned by David Ellison. And former ABC anchor Terry Moran, who lost his job, was recently on CNN discussing that interview.
Look, every network is, as we know, when you get a big presidential interview, there are a lot of people talking to it. Is Barry Weiss, the new editor-in-chief of CBS, who's been very kind to President Trump. Was that part of the equation? It's impossible to say. It was an interview without a lot of pushback. It was an interview that let him carry on.
I wonder what you would have pushed back on, what you would have asked.
Well, at some point, it almost doesn't matter, right? Because he's a tough interview. He's a very tough interview because he's just spewing a lot of stuff that isn't true. You don't have to get in a fight with him. You shouldn't, right? You should treat him with the respect that the office deserves and that the people who elected him deserve. But at the same time, you have to stand up to something, because if you condone his falsehoods, that empowers him. Every authoritarian in the book does this, and you can look it up. And that's what he's doing. So I do think at some point you have to stand up for what is true, even at the risk of displeasing Trump or your bosses.
Terry Moran lost his job from ABC News after he posted that Trump and Stephen Miller are world-class haters. ABC News said that he was suspended pending further evaluation. Terry Moran has since gone independent. He now does interviews on Substack. So listening to both of those clips, and then it's just a reminder to talk about Terry Moran, who lost his job at ABC. Karen, what are your overall thoughts about what that all tells us?
Well, Trump is obviously an equal opportunity offender. He doesn't, you know, confine his attacks to a particular gender. But I will say that the way that these women journalists have been characterized is connected to the authoritarianism as well. I mean, one of my areas of expertise is gender and politics, and authoritarianism itself uses sexism and racism to bolster its power. And so we shouldn't be surprised that he's, the particular way that he's demeaning these women, and it's connected to how women are viewed as credible sources or leaders or voices more broadly in our culture. So part of it is, you know, the sexism is part of the point. But also, I think that it's important for us to realize that, as Mark was saying at the beginning, journalists want to stay in the room. And so when it's not just the Trump administration saying, I'm going to throw you out of this briefing, but it's also your bosses saying, hey, we want Trump to come on 60 Minutes, so act accordingly. It really puts the journalists in a double bind. But I do think that because Trump lies so freely in these interviews, it does put journalists in a different position than they've had to be in before, which is they've got to do fact checking on the spot. And a lot of them, you know, try to do that, but that is a heightened burden, and it kind of changes the journalist's job a little bit in terms of, especially a television journalist, when it's live television. It is incumbent on them to really push back and call out misinformation.
Mark, what are your thoughts?
At the same time, you know, it changes the whole vibe of it, Karen. I'm sure you agree that it's no longer you interviewing somebody, it's you arguing with somebody, because they're saying lie after lie after lie after lie, and you're trying to protect your audience from their lies, so you end up arguing with them. And so it does set the press up to be adversaries, which is, I think, healthy, but it also, for some people, makes it seem as if the press is out to get the person they're interviewing. And so it really spoils the ability of journalists to elicit facts from somebody they're interviewing. And I feel like a really good news organization, and we have none that are quite this good, would make it a pledge that they would not air anything said by any politician that was a lie without immediately fact-checking it. And without immediately correcting it, that they would, you know, and with Trump, you know, he has three lies in three sentences, and then there are three more lies in the next three sentences. So there's just no way of keeping up, which if you had to this pledge in the newsroom that we're not going to let any lie go unchallenged to protect our audience from lies, then you'd be showing a lot less of Trump.
Well, we have a number of callers on the line, so let's take a few and then we'll get responses from our guests. Let's go to Sandra in San Francisco. Hi, Sandra. Thank you for holding.
Yes, hi. My name is Sandra, and I'm one of the many immigrants in California. And I'm pretty sure I am one of many who has escaped dictatorship. We are here not because we really wanted to come here completely, but we ended up here escaping regimes that control media, control education, control the UBS system, And one of the things that hurt the most to me is the control of the PBS here, because it's the only outlet to have education, not only for the general public, but for many, many children and the future generations. Thank you for this program.
Thank you. And can I ask you, Sandra, what do you think overall about media coverage of what we are seeing happen under the second Trump administration?
To me, it's very confusing, especially with the access of no discrimination on fact check, as she was saying, on the internet so openly.
Well, thank you, Sandra. If you're interested, I would love to do a show about this. If you're interested in maybe joining us, can you please give Kevin your phone number? And thank you so much for calling in. I should add that Current, this is a newspaper for people in public media. So not only is the West Coast News Bureau going to be shut down for the PBS NewsHour, but the PBS News Weekend is going to be canceled. And this is really a loss, because if you watch the PBS NewsHour, it's one of the only places where you can still get a 10-minute, really great in-depth report about such a wide range of issues. We should actually do a show about this, because they do such important reporting. So thank you for the call. We'll get a response in just a minute. Let's go to Connie in Palo Alto. Hi, Connie. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. And I really appreciate the conversation about journalism and the very difficult job that reporters have in the country today. But my question is about what I'm seeing as kind of the double standard approach to covering Trump, normalizing a lot of the things that he does is outside the pale for coverage just generally. And as an example, when I was trained as a journalist, we used to put people's ages in stories in one two-digit way to define who they are. I hardly ever see a story, just a general story that includes the president's age as a matter of course, unless somebody has very rarely brought up the issue of his health. And I say that rarely because I don't see a lot of coverage of that, or as much as I did under the prior president. So can you talk a little bit about some of the standards? We used to have things called size and scope. If you're asking the president about, Saudi Arabia, the first thing you would say is, in the story, President Trump hosted, the prince from Saudi Arabia, where his family has made X many dollars, or pushing a cyber security policy or a cyber currency policy at the same time earning X many billion dollars. Those are facts, size and scope. And I'm not seeing that basic journalism principles applied, because there's some sort of exception to how we cover the president. Again, difficult, I understand, but why?
Great question, Connie. Thank you so much. We'll get a response in just a minute. Let's first go to Parker in San Francisco. Hi, Parker. Oh, Parker dropped off, but Parker wanted to talk about the fact that there seems to be a popularity with authoritarianism around the world. Why is this? How did this happen? Thoughts about caller questions? Which one you'd like to take first? Do you want to start, Karin?
Sure. I'll start with that second question. The sort of why aren't reporters covering Trump in a double standard for making him sound more reasonable than he is in many cases. There was a really striking New York Times Sunday opinion page right before the 2024 election. It was October 29th, 2024. And the New York Times Sunday opinion did this full page that was just the following headline. It said, Donald Trump says he will prosecute his enemies, order mass deportations, use soldiers against citizens, abandon allies, play politics with disasters. Believe him. Okay. So there was this news cycle around believe Trump, believe what he says. And this was the New York Times opinion section, attempt to say, don't vote this into office. We haven't seen that kind of really clear, explicit messaging from an outlet like The Times since Trump got reelected. And I think that what Mark is pointing to and what some of the callers are pointing to is that's what we need. We need really simple, explicit messaging, particularly since if you look at the things that The Times put on their list in October 29th, all of those things have happened in just the first year of Trump's second term. Hmm. So they know how to do it. They just need to start doing it again.
What would you add about this, Mark? Because we saw some of this during the Trump's first term. I mean, they're going much, much further this time. But you also have to add the question in there, what did they learn from the first term?
Nothing. I mean, this is the most frustrating thing is how little has been learned by mainstream news. And I think that part of it is that what I wrote this week about what the media has its own pardon process. It has the ability to forget facts that are relevant when it's dealing with certain people. For example, you almost never see in news stories about Donald Trump any statement that he's a convicted felon, even though he is. And it's actually a pretty important fact when you're talking about the president of the United States. But I think that the news major media have decided that it would make them look partisan to remind people that the president of the United States was convicted of 34 felonies. But it's not. And it's especially relevant when Trump is accusing somebody else of crimes. I mean, so, and I, in this column I wrote, this my newsletter, I went through some, you know, references where people they should be talking about when Trump accuses some opponent of committing a crime. Why wouldn't you say Trump, who has been convicted of 34 felonies, comma, said? I mean, because he's accusing them of a crime. So isn't it important to remind your audience that he committed crimes too? I mean, so there's all this. And with Steve Bannon, was my prime example in the newsletter that people keep on calling him a one-time presidential advisor or a podcaster or this. They don't talk about the fact that he has been convicted of crimes and he's done prison time. And when instead they make him out to be some sort of wise man on policy issues. It's exasperating.
Also, it's easy to forget that in May 2023, a jury found Trump liable for sexually abusing E. Jean Carroll in 1996, awarding her $5 million. And so that goes to the question that Connie raised about following basic standards to include this information in pieces. What are your thoughts about that, Karin?
I think it's pretty clear that the people at the head of our institutions, whether that be the media or politics or higher education, there are many, many people who do not care about sexual harassment, who do not care about sexual assault, who think that's a separate category of he said, she said, and even when there are convictions, can we ever really know what happened? There's a deep strain of sexism. I mean, when you have somebody as popular as Megyn Kelly talking about the fact that is 15 really, statutory rape? Is that really pedophile? There's just a deep unwillingness for people to recognize the seriousness of harassment and assault. And it traces back to sexism, I think.
Mark, real quick,
for people who might not know about this. So NPR has a piece yesterday, What Does 15 Look Like? Teens and former child actors weigh in online after Megyn Kelly comments. She downplayed the youth of Jeffrey Epstein's victims on her podcast, just to let people know if they haven't been following this.
This is just an example of people who are just eager to lower their own personal standards to match the low standards of the would-be dictator. I mean, it's really that sad. And you had an entire political party, except for like four people, decide that they wanted to cover up the Epstein files. And then they flipped as soon as Trump flipped. We're still going to have to see what happens with that. But people who are like, it's just shocking that people are not shocked by something like the Epstein files and Trump's involvement with that. And there's this attempt to just avoid the facts at all costs that just show. I mean, Trump, for example, he was joking about how his 17-year-old daughter told him, promised him she would he would not date anyone younger than her. Well, 17 is the age of consent in New York. So in effect, his daughter was asking him not to commit statutory rape. And that was some sort of like funny thing they said on the media. I mean, people need to get serious about sexual abuse. They just need, and the fact that the Republican Party doesn't want to should be appalling and disqualifying.
We need to do a show about that. We have just a few minutes left. A number of people are writing in with sites that they like. Graham writes, Drop Sites Doing Crucial Work, headed by Jeremy Scahill and Ryan Grimm. The Majority Report broadcasts daily on YouTube. They have great guests. Graham also mentions Hassan Piker and then the Daily Blast. What about these independent outlets? I think of ProPublica. I mean, they are doing incredible investigative reporting on a regular basis. Do you think that these independent outlets are making a dent in all of this? There's so much out there now, Karin, it's hard to keep up, but sites like ProPublica really need to be applauded for the work that they're doing.
Absolutely. ProPublica is great. I will shout out the 19th News. They do news and reporting that focuses on all issues, but particularly on women and gender, things that pertain to women and gender. So I do think that you have these specialty outlets that are popping up. I mean, independent journalist Aaron Reed is doing really great reporting on what's happening with transgender folks and this administration. So I think following those independent voices is good. But the thing that makes ProPublica so effective is that, again, you do need an organizational structure to be able to do investigative reporting. One person on a Substack really just doesn't have the resources to do that. So we need to get serious as citizens about supporting the high quality news that is out there but needs more money to run. So that's how the public radio model works. And we need to put our dollars and our subscription dollars behind our news priorities.
And your thoughts on that, Mark? 30 seconds.
Yeah, I would say that The Guardian needs to be paid attention to. Really sad that a UK-based outlet is doing a better job on American politics than Americans are. I totally agree with ProPublica. They need money. Guardian needs money. Heather Cox Richardson's newsletter is terrific. There are a lot of places to get news that aren't ABC, CBS, and NBC.
Mark Jacob is former Metro editor of the Chicago Tribune and former Sunday editor of the Chicago Sun-Times. He now writes the Stop the Press's newsletter. Dr. Karin Vazbee Anderson is professor of communication studies at Colorado State University. Karin and Mark, thank you so much for your work and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for this conversation.
Thank you. And you can find some of the resources we discussed today at KALW.org, click news and your call. Thanks to Nina Kissinger for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call's authoritarian playbook.